From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a new report by the Wisconsin Policy Forum sheds light on the affordable housing crisis here in Milwaukee.
Then the D.C.-based Millennial Action Project joins forces with several Milwaukee institutions to foster civil dialogue.
I'm a big believer that a more constructive political discourse is a habit that needs to be turned into ultimately a norm.
Later, the author of Milwaukee Ghosts and Legends talks about some local spirits and the things that connect ghost stories of all kinds.
There are definitely reoccurring themes, and I think it's because at the heart of all ghost stories, it's a human story.
And Milwaukee Magazine has its readers select their choices for the best things the city has to offer. Lake Effect is next, but first the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Americans are facing an affordable housing crisis. In some cities, the main issues are availability and soaring housing prices. But in Milwaukee, the biggest issue seems to be income. While housing prices have steadily increased, wages remain stagnant.
This mix of low-income renters and few affordable apartments has led to many Milwaukeeans being rent-burdened. Joe Pietrangelo is a senior researcher with the Wisconsin Policy Forum, which just released a report on the cost of living in the Milwaukee area. Pietrangelo spoke with Joy Powers, and he starts by explaining the questions they hope to answer with this report.
We had done some research 2009 looking at the affordable housing issue here in Milwaukee County, and we wanted to know how have things changed since before the recession till today in terms of the affordable housing landscape. Have rents gone up significantly? Has the supply of affordable housing changed significantly? Things like that.
So what has changed since the Great Recession? And can you give us kind of a timeline here? When does the Great Recession end in this case? And when does the next phase begin?
Sure. The recession technically started in 2008 and ended, I think, in 2010. But it affected Milwaukee for several years after. And so it's really been in the last few years that the local economy has strengthened a lot. And so that was where we were trying to see where are things at today compared to before 2008. And what we saw is there's been a shift from owning to renting. That was one significant shift that took place to the point where renters are now a majority in Milwaukee County. It's a pretty unusual and striking finding that more than half of all households are renters. Statewide, it's about a third. So it's a significant difference here versus throughout the state, and it's also been an increase since 10 years ago.
I noticed that. I was rather surprised. It seems as though the percentage of renters is comparable with much larger counties, much larger metropolises. And in fact, your report said that Milwaukee County has the highest number of renters of anywhere in the Midwest.
Yeah, that was a really striking finding for us. We were surprised as well. We found, that the only large counties, we looked at all the counties in the country with at least 500,000 people and found that the only ones that had a higher percentage of renting households were in the New York, San Francisco, LA, and Boston. So the biggest metro areas on the coasts, Milwaukee County had the highest rate of renting in the Midwest. Dallas County was one other in the South that was very high, but we were 11th among large counties in the country.
What does that kind of number say about the housing situation in Milwaukee?
It just points to the high demand there is for rental housing. And this study specifically looked at the private rental market. So we know that most people do not receive vouchers or any kind of subsidies. There's a small share that do, but there's also just a high demand for renting in the private market. And that's particularly the case here in Milwaukee County.
So let's get into some of the numbers. We have a lot of renters, and of those renters, it seems that many of them are burdened by their housing expenses. When we say that term, you know, what does that mean?
Yeah, so a national threshold that is used frequently is 30% of your income spent on rent is sort of a maximum affordable amount. So whenever a household is spending more than 30% of their income on rent, that would be considered a rent burden. We also looked at when households spend over half of their income on rent as a severe rent burden. So those were two thresholds we used to see how are things going in Milwaukee County versus other counties in the state and nation. We actually found that about half of renter households in Milwaukee County, almost exactly half, are paying more than 30% of their income for rent. So it's a very common issue, and that was, again, much higher than surrounding counties and the state as a whole. So a significant problem. We also found that a quarter altogether, so half of the half, are spending more than 50% of their income on housing. So those are severely rent-burdened households.
One thing that the report said was the greatest single barrier is not the amount of housing that's out there, but really the amount of money that people are making. So how does that play out? What is the median household income compared to the median rent?
We found in Milwaukee County, the median income, after taking into account paying the median rent, the median income is $45 short of being able to afford that rent without going into that burden, so spending more than 30% of their income on rent. So basically the income is just not high enough to afford the median rent. And that was true also in Racine County. They had very similar numbers to Milwaukee County. But then when we looked at some of the other suburban counties around Milwaukee, when we looked at the state as a whole, we found that that was not the case. So the income was high enough to afford the median rent. So that was another way that we really measured affordability or lack thereof.
So who's being impacted by this in Milwaukee?
Well, the lowest income households, we found actually 42% of households in Milwaukee County, of renter households, are earning under $25,000 per year. So 42%, but and then only 9% of the housing units are priced at a point where those households could afford them without being rent burdened. So it's a very low rent that those households could afford without being rent burdened. It's a $500 rent, and only 9% of the units are that low in cost. And of course, in many cases, those lower income households are larger households with children, and the units that tend to be under $500 are studios and things like that. So there's a real crunch there. And so a lot of those lower income households tend to be spending too high of a percentage on their housing.
You know, across the nation, we're looking at what some people have called a housing crisis. And it seems to vary in every metropolitan area, really how that's playing out. Where does Milwaukee fit into this larger national trend?
It's a great question. I mean, really what we found, and you kind of alluded to this earlier, is that it's more of an income issue in Milwaukee, perhaps, compared to nationally, where in some of those coastal cities, you see rents that are just exorbitantly high, and that even if you had a solid income, it's difficult to afford those rents in some places. Where in Milwaukee County, we looked at the median rent, compared it to other places. The Milwaukee County median rent is lower than that in other bigger cities or bigger counties in the region, like Dane County, where Madison's located, Hennepin County, where the Twin Cities or Minneapolis, Cook County, and also statewide and nationally. So we looked at all of those levels, and Milwaukee County's median rent is modest. So it's not so much that we have very high rents, but we have a larger percentage of households that are earning low incomes and are renting and are therefore burdened and trying to afford the rents.
So when we look at solutions to this issue, who needs to be at the table for that discussion?
Yeah, so we touched on some of the solutions that are being implemented locally already, things that the city is involved in and nonprofits. There is a lot of work going on to develop more affordable housing, and that is an area where it can be easier to, not easy, but easier to make a change on the supply side in terms of developing more affordable housing, rehabilitating affordable housing. But then on the income side, since we did find that incomes are more of the problem here, that's a much more difficult problem to address. And so, you know, that's where economic development, workforce development efforts that are longer term in nature really are needed, absent things that would change at the federal level in terms of, you know, increasing housing vouchers or something along those lines. We're really talking about increasing incomes, which can be somewhat controlled locally and somewhat is affected by global trends.
Yeah. Well, Joe, thank you so much for speaking with me today and for this report.
Thank you very much.
Joe Pietrangelo is a senior researcher with the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Their report, The Cost of Living, is out now. For more, you can head over to WUWM.com.
Coming up next, the story behind this week's Across the Red and Blue Divide event on criminal justice reform. Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, in just a moment. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. For more than a year, WUWM and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel have partnered on a conversation series in an effort to bring people of differing political philosophies together. The aim of the Across the Divide series is not to persuade one side to think like the other, rather to give people insights into how and why others think about issues.
At the same time, another local organization has been inviting people to take part in a similar effort. It's a critical part of what the Zeidler Center for Public Discussion is all about. This week, the two efforts will come together with the support of the Washington, D.C.-based Millennial Action Project.
The event is called Across the Red and Blue Divide, Reforming Criminal Justice. We're joined in the studio by the Zeidler Center's director, Catherine Wilson, and the Journal Sentinel's Aaron Richards, and on the phone by Millennial Action Project founder and president and Brookfield native Stephen Olicara. Welcome to all of you.
It's great to be here.
Thank
Thanks.
You.
Thank you.
I want to start with a question about what the Millennial Action Project is and what makes what you do such a good fit with what we're doing in Milwaukee or just outside Milwaukee in the coming days.
Sure. Well, the vision for MAP originated from my experience growing up in Milwaukee as a musician. One of the interesting dynamics of the Metro Milwaukee area is, despite how polarized it is, there are some forces like music, for example, that allow us to transcend those divides. And of course, that's a microcosm of what we are seeing nationally today. For example, in Congress, partisan polarization is at its worst level since the end of Reconstruction. So we founded Millennial Action Project in 2013, in the wake of the government shutdown, to be an antidote to the polarization and bridge the partisan divide. And we focus on the next generation of leadership because they are the future of our country. And I think this rising millennial generation gives us our greatest hope to come together politically. So we engage young elected officials in Congress and state legislatures through a network of bipartisan future caucuses who work together in a bipartisan fashion on the challenges facing our future. And that's ranged from economic empowerment and innovation to democracy reform. And now with this conversation, we'll be focusing on criminal justice reform. And it's been growing fast. And the good news is I think that this younger generation really does have a chance to transform American politics for the better.
So talk about how this dovetails with the mission of the Zeidler Center.
Well, it dovetails nicely because the Zeidler Center has been committed to facilitating dialogues across the political divide. And at the beginning of this year, we worked together to launch a new program called the Red and Blue Dialogues. in Milwaukee to facilitate these conversations along with not only community members, but our young elected officials who have been part of our work. And so after we kicked it off back in March, we've hosted conversations on higher education and fake news. And we're now thrilled to be partnering with the Journal Sentinel and WUWMs across the Divide series. We're joining forces on this program on September 6th, focused on criminal justice reform.
Yeah, I would say that the mission of the Zeither Center is to foster civil dialogue and invite trust in the midst of differences. And so our mission is to make sure that we're bringing facilitators and convening the public in such a way that it's not a debate, that people from across the divide can come and feel deeply heard. The Zeither Center works and convenes thousands of people each year in dialogues on our most challenging issues, and politics is certainly one of those. And overwhelmingly, people have said, or the majority of people say that I just want to be heard. Oftentimes, when we have political dialogues, you know, it just becomes a shouting match. And so how can we convene and have some structure and facilitators that guide a conversation so that people really walk away feeling heard and that their ideas are deeply valued?
And in the midst of all this, Aaron Richards, the Journal Sentinel and WWM have been running a series of events called Across the Divide, which seemed to seemed to go along nicely with the goal of these events.
Mitch, as you know, we launched this effort really after the 2016 election to recognize that there are a lot of folks across our state that would like to be having discussions but maybe aren't, or maybe there's challenges to speaking across the political divide. So since early 2017, we've hosted a number of discussions on everything from political polarization itself to the Me Too movement to what's next for school choice. And I think all of those events have brought out a good array of people who want to talk about these issues. But I think what's unique about this event is that it certainly brings in the Zeither Center, which has this great strength of actually not just letting people listen to experts, but really facilitating dialogues. And when I've been to Zeither Center discussions, I've really appreciated the opportunity to hear from people in small groups. It's a different kind of experience. And as a matter of fact, at that very first event that we hosted at Maxie's back in early 2017 about political polarization, someone came up to me after the event and they said, "Great job, love this idea, but have you thought about doing small group discussion circles at the end like the Zeither Center does?" And I was like, "I know, that's great. Maybe we'll get around to that one day."
Well, and so, Catherine Wilson, talk about how the small group discussion circles work vis-a-vis the panel discussion that kind of kicks off the entire event.
Yeah, so people come together. We have a large group presentation. In this event, there'll be a panel, a bipartisan panel, to discuss the issue and to get people's ideas flowing. And then they will have already been seated in circles with a Zeither Center facilitator in each circle. And the facilitator will ask a series of questions, give people time to take notes, and each person will have an opportunity to speak on the questions, given the same amount of time to speak. The idea being that that no one is interrupting you when you're speaking. There's some agreements in place. And then from the structured part of the circling, there is a time of open conversation where people really get into the habit of civility during the structured part so that they're more open to really having that great dialogue across the divide that we don't usually get, whether it's online or just in our daily conversations.
Stephen, can you talk about the experiences that the Millennial Action Project has had along the way, you know, the challenges and you know, successes and things that maybe have not gone as you'd hoped or expected, but you've used as learning tools?
Well, you know, Catherine mentioned such a good point about the habit of civility. And I'm a big believer that a more constructive political discourse is a, you know, habit that needs to be turned into ultimately a norm. Unfortunately, today, one of the great challenges is that you know, our political incentives, often the media incentives, often push us towards disagreement without looking at the many areas where we might have common ground. And that, I think, recently has metastasized into full-scale political tribalism, that is, being against another side simply because of who they are and not about the idea they are proposing. So that's why I think this type of program is so important, especially when we have so many of these challenges that are, I think, pushing us apart. We need the types of dialogues that, you know, the organizations involved here are doing to really be an antidote to that. And the good news is, I think the hunger is there, and every event we've done, the attendance has increased in size. And I think generally people feel good. There is a need, and I think, and a hunger for these types of dialogues.
So let me ask all three of you, why criminal justice and why now?
Certainly speaking, from the side of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and as an education reporter, I'm particularly interested in youth criminal justice and where there is room to talk about how young people get off track, how we reintegrate young people who have offended in some way. There's a lot of gaps in those systems between the children's court system and rehabilitation programs and the integration of the city school system or other schools that children may be going to or coming from. And so one of the guests at this event is Judge Jane Carroll, who's been a longtime children's court judge. I believe she's into rotation in another court right now. But I think it's really important to hear from people within those institutions. If you yourself haven't touched that institution, or if you don't know someone who's been in that institution, it's very easy to think of it as kind of an other thing that doesn't really affect you. But I think what we're learning from all of these types of issues is that they really do have implications for where we're going as a city and a community and an economy. And so I'm eager to at least touch on that part of the issue for our audience.
One reason Millennial Action Project is interested in criminal justice reform is it is a bipartisan opportunity. And that's actually a big thing we do with our young lawmakers, is help them identify those opportunities and help provide the resources for them to turn those ideas into legislation. And in Wisconsin, we recently saw a pretty promising bipartisan effort around the closure of the Lincoln Hills Youth Prison. That bill actually passed the assembly unanimously. And you saw conservatives making conservative arguments for it. You saw progressives making progressive arguments for it. So they weren't giving up their principles, but they saw a common solution that advanced their respective values in politics. And that's why I think this is such a compelling area. On the Republican side, you see a lot of interest to reduce the prison population, to ultimately reduce the size of its budgetary burden. Right now, corrections is the third largest expenditure in the Wisconsin budget. And on the progressive side, a lot of interest in helping the most vulnerable populations get a second chance and reintegrate in society. So you're seeing a lot increasing alignment, and I'm very encouraged by that. And I'm hopeful to, you know, we can further explore that through our discussions.
And going off that, I think you said an important point, Stephen, about values, that we want people to come to the dialogue not thinking that we're trying to make Republicans Democrats or Democrats Republicans, that depolarization is not necessarily consensus building where everyone has to agree, getting to the point where we can disagree without being disagreeable, and that we can also work for mutual understanding and those places where bipartisan efforts can really be successful. I think that's the goal. So when people hear dialogue, I think we don't want them to think that they need to go into the space thinking that they'll be asked to change their political views, but that it is a space of creativity and really an opportunity to build understanding across the divide.
And I think that spirit is politics at our best. And I think it's so important that when we talk about political bridge building, we really distinguish between there's one style where, and people often associate bipartisanship with this. You're finding the least common denominator. You're compromising your principles, and you're reaching a worse result. And then there's a different style that is, you know, where we're marshaling the best ideas, you know, from all the different sides that are in alignment with our principles. And just like you would in a startup, for example, you want the best ideas and the best talent, regardless of where they come from. That's what we need in our politics. And, you know, it reminds me of the jazz combos. When I would perform at the Jazz Estate in Milwaukee, for example, you know, it's a constant exchange of ideas. And that's really, you know, democracy at its best.
Well, Stephen, Catherine, and Aaron, thank you to all of you for setting the stage for what I hope will be a terrific event.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Wisconsin native Stephen Olicara is the founder and president of the Washington, D.C.-based Millennial Action Project. Catherine Wilson is the director of the Zeidler Center for Public Discussion. Aaron Richards is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and will co-moderate, along with Mitch, Thursday's event, Across the Red and Blue Divide, Reforming Criminal Justice. You can learn more about it and RSVP to attend at WUWM.com.
After a break, we'll chat with the author of a new book on what might be haunting Milwaukee buildings. Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Scary stories are a classic part of childhood. A whistling wind or a bump in the night heighten the drama of these tales and keep listeners coming back for more.
Like a lot of kids, Anna Lardinoy loved these stories, but unlike a lot of adults, she's made her living through telling them. Lardinoy is the founder of Gothic Milwaukee, through which she gives haunted historical walking tours of the city.
She's also the author of Milwaukee Ghosts and Legends. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about her new book and what first drew her to ghostly tales.
I've loved ghost stories ever since I was a little kid. When I was growing up, we used to take turns telling each other scary stories and seeing who could be the scariest. And I always loved that activity. I would keep up late at night being so scared about the stories that I already told that I knew I made up. So I've just always been intrigued by that genre. And as I got older, I made doing ghost tours part of my vacations. So every new city I'd go to a haunted walking tour because I think it's a really fun way to learn history in the city and take a different look at new places. So with all that love of the storytelling and that ghostly aspect, I've started Gothic Milwaukee, my walking tours here. And in gathering all of those tales, I had a number of stories that really didn't fit into tours. So a book seemed like a great way to share them with people.
Yeah. So you've taken a number of tours around the country, I'm assuming.
Mm-hmm. Even the world.
Even the world.
Yes.
Are there recurring themes that you see?
Absolutely. I was actually just talking about this week, how almost every classic theater is a haunted theater, and they're all haunted in almost always the same ways. There is always, you know, an actor who still has not taken their last bow. There is always a stage manager who is still watching over the house. There is always someone in the lighting room in all of these theaters and all over the country. And philosophically, it's hard to understand why that is. Is that part of nature that, you know, these people fill these roles? Is it part of our collective imagination? It's hard to know exactly why that is, but there are definitely reoccurring themes. And I think it's because at the heart of all ghost stories, it's a human story. And humans just aren't all that different.
Well, and perhaps it's part of the drama of theater and people who inhabit those spaces.
It could very well be those type of people fill those roles and then they go on to continue to fill those roles. I just did a discussion about haunted theaters in Wisconsin, and one of the ones I talked about was the Grand Opera in Oshkosh. It's not in the book, but it's still really interesting because it's considered one of our most haunted buildings. And the primary apparition there is a man named Percy Keene. And he worked at that theater from 1895 until he died in 1967. So he was there for 72 years, I believe, working there. So in that case, it's not hard for me to believe that his spirit lingers on there, because that must have been the bulk of his life.
Yeah. We actually have our own haunted theater here in Milwaukee.
The Riverside is a noted haunted theater. We, of course, have the Modjeska Theater, which is supposed to be famously haunted. And as far as college campuses go, there claims to be two haunted theaters on Marquette's campus. So something about theaters is just a spirit magnet, and they all like to stay around.
Well, and Marquette is considered perhaps the most haunted campus in the state of Wisconsin.
Absolutely.
Where do ghosts seem to linger in Marquette?
Well, ghosts are attracted to that campus for a number of different reasons. And probably the most popular stories go back to dorms that had originally been used for something else. And you might know that one of the dorms used to be a children's hospital. And in that dorm, there are lots of ghostly tales of young patients that have still not made their way out of there. There is also famously a swimming ghost in that dorm who will take late night dips with unsuspecting swimmers. But that's not the only campus around that has these legends. There are stories that refer to Cardinal Stritch and Concordia, and there are even a few that are lingering, they say, at UW-Milwaukee.
At UW-Milwaukee. Are any of those in the book?
The UW-Milwaukee one did not make this book. It may make another, but there are a number of creepy campuses that are highlighted in the book. So it's lots of fun for me to do something like this because I love reading ghost books, but a lot of ghost books I read, I can't tell where they're talking about. And it's so incredibly vague that it could be anywhere. But in this book, there are pictures of the actual locations. The building is identified. It has the address when possible. And I like that for people who are extra curious or want to go to a haunted restaurant or want to drive by a haunted house or just like those stories. There's a little bit more there to cling on to.
Well, it's especially helpful because some of the buildings that might have had a specific name, I should say, mm-hmm. in the ghost story mm-hmm. now are used very differently. Going back to the campus theme, you mentioned right. MSOE and Blatt's Brewery.
Right. Valentin Blatt's story to me is really interesting because it is kind of a nutshell of Milwaukee because it has a beer baron, it has some populist ideas, it has a hard work ethic. It's very Milwaukee. So Valentin Blatt immigrates to America. He ends up working for Braun, who has a brewery. And when he dies, when Braun dies, rather, Blatt marries his widow. And then it becomes a Blatt's Brewery. And he is a very hardworking man, very well respected in Milwaukee. And you would not think a man like that, who was really known for being down to earth and not showy, would have any paranormal things about him at all. But he had a premonition that he was going to die if he ever went to California, which seems like a very easy thing to avoid. But his wife, every year, went to California to avoid winter. She was in poor health. And one year, she was just not feeling well, and he knew how much she wanted to go out there. And he's like, how am I letting this ridiculous premonition rule me? And so he's like, you know, this is silliness. He goes with her to California. While he's out there, he enters the beer into some contest that they would have not have been in because of his phobia of going to California, and they win. And it's really a long trip because that's how people used to travel at that time. And then it took them, you know, a number of days to get back. And he makes it all the way to St. Paul, and they stop for the night in St. Paul, the train does, and he ends up dying of a heart attack in St. Paul. So he comes back to Milwaukee, but not alive. And this happens so suddenly and so unexpectedly that when the newspapers contact their adult children to get a comment on this, they think it's a mistake. They're like, my dad's not dead. So what a terrible way to find out that your dad died. So they come back like a day later, you know, delay with the dead body. And then a few days later, he's laid to rest in the Forest Home Cemetery. And he was such a well-respected man that even though they wanted to have a private funeral for him, there was a line that took almost 3 hours to get through around their home of people who wanted to pay respect to this man. So that should be the end of this story. It's, you know, unusual that he had that premonition. But many, many people believe that a few days later, his spirit comes back to work and begins working in that office again. And this is such a pervasive belief that in the 1990s, people are still telling this story, and they're telling it even more after this becomes part of the MSOE campus. So as a lark, some of the people who work there pool their money together, and they get a psychic to come and do a seance with them on Halloween night in this office to see if they can summon Platts. And so, and I just want to pause to say, I know this story because it was actually in the Milwaukee Journal, published as news, which I love because throughout history, this kind of thing has been published in the paper. So as much as we might want to distance ourselves by being modern or sophisticated, it is so ingrained in our society. But I digress. So they have this seance, and these perfectly sane, employed, wonderful people say that they feel a presence in the room, and it becomes colder, and there's a breeze blowing through. And according to the people there that night, they could not summon Valentin Blatz. However, they do think they connect it with a spirit that may have been involved in the business and did some shady accounting irregularities in the 1930s. And as somebody who is just looking at Milwaukee history, it really doesn't surprise me that Valentin Blatz would not come to a seance. Because I would imagine if you are a man who died and then returned to work, you have no time for foolishness. You are in that office for a reason. You're building your empire. So it doesn't surprise me that they wouldn't. But I think the better part of that story is how much it has captured the imagination of generations of Milwaukeeans and how we're still interested in that story.
Well, there are other ghosts of this ilk, specifically in downtown Milwaukee.
Absolutely.
There's, of course, the Pfister ghost.
Yes.
There's the ghost at the Eagles Club. I actually did a piece on the Eagles Club not so long ago, and I will say the number one thing that everyone asked about as I was doing this research is, oh, well, are you researching the ghost? Because apparently this is a huge thing. So I know a bit of this story at this point, but the information has come from a lot of odd sources. What's the story behind the Eagles Club ghost?
Well, you know, that's a great question because I think that I maybe give in the book an overview that there may not be a reasonable story about the rave or Eagles Room ghost. There is definitely someone who did die in the Eagles Club, and they died in the pool. So all of that is very true. However, a lot of the other stories that you hear about, like roaming bands of sinister children, it's really hard to track down historically what could have happened that would cause there to be a group of sinister children that are lurking in the night, because there have been no, at least that I'm aware of, no mass casualty of a number of children. There was no terrible accident where several kids died at the same time or anything. So I'm not sure where those otherworldly children would be, but there are so many stories with that building, and it's really fascinating, and I think it's definitely part of the mystique of going there.
So if you're someone who is reading this book, you know, you're really intrigued about a lot of these ghosts and these legends. You know, as a tour guide in Milwaukee, where would you suggest that they go?
Well, Two of my favorite places are, of course, we cannot ignore the Pfister Hotel. The Pfister is Milwaukee's most famously haunted building. And beyond having, in my opinion, one of the most cordial, welcoming ghosts of the whole city, it's an incredibly beautiful place to be. So even if nothing spine-tingling happens, you are going to have an amazing time because it's just truly such a beautiful building. And I have a personal fondness for City Hall because it's so amazingly historic and it's beautiful, and I feel such a sense of civic pride when I'm in there. And even if the stories that are connected to it aren't your cup of tea, you're still going to get a great piece of Milwaukee history there.
All right. Well, Anna, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with me today and telling me a bit about our ghost history.
I thank you so much for having me. I really do appreciate this opportunity.
Anna Lardinoy is the author of Milwaukee Ghosts and Legends, as well as the founder of Gothic Milwaukee, where she gives haunted historical walking tours of the city. Lardinoy spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers.
We will take one last break, and then Milwaukee Magazine turns over the responsibilities for choosing the best of Milwaukee to its readers. We'll hear some of the results when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Milwaukee Magazine is a publication about the many things the city has to offer, but it devotes one issue a year to the best of the city and the surrounding area.
But for the first time in recent memory, this year's Best of Milwaukee feature is a Reader's Choice edition. Choosing from nominees selected by magazine editors, the readership voted on everything from Best Burger to Best Aesthetician.
Easy for you to say. There were plenty of Editor's Choice awards, and so editor and publisher Carol Nixon is the perfect person to visit the studio today to share the highlights from both readers and editors. Nice to see you. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mitch. How are you?
I'm doing all right.
Great.
The summer is over spiritually anyway.
Yeah.
but you know, there's a lot that's outdoors in this list. And, you know, just because Labor Day has passed, it doesn't mean we can't go out and do things. But, you know, I always think, when you're doing a best of, you kind of put your fate in readers' hands when you do a survey like this. Like, you're never sure what you might get.
That's very true. And this is the first time, at least in recent memory, that we've turned the reins over to the reader. Typically, it's the editor's, you know, picks and choices. And we do some editor's picks in this issue as well. But we just decided to, I don't know, change it up and to hear from readers. And we created the categories, and we kind of did a informal polling of friends and acquaintances to get a list of nominees for every category. There was also a write-in vote if you didn't like our nominees.
Did any write-in votes
win
carry the
ultimately?
Day?
No. You know, it's hard for a write-in vote to win just because it starts to splinter off, you know? So, but no, we didn't have any write-in votes win.
But I imagine part of the trick to keeping this interesting is coming up with interesting categories.
Yes, yes. And I thought that was one of the great things about turning it over to the readers, because editors, as brilliant and expansive as they are, everyone's knowledge is a little bit limited. So when it came to things like, I don't know, best decorator, I don't think anyone on my staff, myself included, has ever hired a decorator. So what do we know? But there are people who do know. And so we were able to add some of those categories to this. And I think that I think it makes it more useful and just more fun.
I remember living in, it was like a medium-sized city that will remain nameless some years ago, and the local magazine did a reader's pick best of and wound up, you know, finding out that the reader's picks for best Italian food, it was the Olive Garden, and best pizza was Pizza Hut, and it was a little cringe-inducing. The readers of Milwaukee Magazine seem to have somewhat more refined taste than that.
You know, I think
our slogan is Read Local. And I think that our readers would expand upon that to, you know, they try to do everything local. And that's why they read the magazine, to find out what's going on, not to find out about Pizza Hut, Olive Garden, or Walmart.
The photography was an interesting way to get at this. I was struck by how you managed to work in, you know, the best dry cleaner and the best veterinarian in with the best bars.
Well, you know, that was a fun shoot. We did it at the Jazz Estate. And our idea was to bring, you know, there were some individuals who won, like Beth Jaworski for Best Realtor and Melinda Wilkie for Best Wealth Manager. And so we thought, well, let's create sort of a little, you know, little cocktail hour, happy hour slash cocktail party. You know, who would you want to talk to? And it's like, well, I want to talk to the wealth manager and find out what I should be doing. And I want to talk to the veterinarian because I have two cats and they're always, you know, I've always got questions about them. They're mysteries to me. And then, you know, yes, we had a category for best dry cleaner. And so that was just kind of a fun way to have the bartender wiping a spot on his vest and in dire need of a good dry cleaner, which I might add was Natural Cleaners here in Milwaukee. So.
And the best veterinarian who is in this picture, Dr. Jacob Otters of Lakeshore Veterinary Specialist, must have been a little surprised to find out that his shoot was taking place at the Jazz Estate.
He was, but, you know, the nice thing is everybody just went along with it, and it was great. And we also have the best event planner in there, from Lux Events, and that's Matthew Richt. Yeah, it was a good group, and I was there at that shoot, and I certainly enjoyed the cocktail patter.
Well, let's talk about the best of that adorns the cover and also is, I think, maybe the first best of listed in this article, and it is the best addition to the skyline, and I think a lot of people would probably agree with this.
You know, that was my pick, and each of the editors, staff members got to pick a few of their own. And so this was my pick, and it appeared on the scene. It's the mosaic water tower that sits above the Coakley Brothers offices. And it appeared last fall, right after our Best Of came out last year. And so ever since then, I've been, you know, I have a little post-it note on my desk that this was my best of pick. And it's just beautiful. I mean, I was talking to someone recently since the issue came out, and she said, you know, I saw your cover, but I've never seen that. And I advised her to look up. And I think a lot of people don't look up, but it's beautiful in the daytime. At night, it's illuminated from inside, and it's plexiglass, but it looks like stained glass. And it just glows, and it's just a little magical addition to our skyline. And it has special, you know, extra meaning for me because there's quite a few by this artist in New York City. His name is Tom Fruin. So I see those when I go back to New York to visit friends and land at the airport, and coming into Manhattan, you see them above Brooklyn. And so it's a little piece of New York here in Milwaukee.
And look up would be a good hashtag, I think.
Yeah, hashtag look up. Hashtag read local. I got a few.
Well, let's talk about the editor's picks. You mentioned you'd had the water tower on a post-it note at your desk. I imagine the people who get to contribute to these editor's picks probably also have post-it notes at their desks. What are some of the other best ofs that weren't necessarily selected by readers but might make readers go, yeah, I would agree with that?
Well, our art director, Paul Higgins, came up with lunchtime at IKEA, and I was very interested to find out, you know, sometimes his lunch hours run long, and I'm like, where are you? And it turns out he's at IKEA.
It's kind of a haul from your offices.
But he claims you can get there in 15 minutes, and I actually did time it, and that's accurate. But I think the problem is once you get there and you've had lunch, it's really hard to resist looking, you know, looking around a little, maybe buying
a few
things. Yeah, exactly. But I have a personal affection for IKEA and also for Swedish meatballs. So
and their lunches are kind of a bargain, I have to say.
Oh, my gosh, they're a great bargain. And it's not all Swedish meatballs. You can get salmon and lots of other Swedish dishes for under $10, and you'll feel like you had a little mini vacation.
And then bring the lingonberry drink home with you and set it on your desk.
Bring it for your boss and appease her.
Exactly. You had another entry in the editor's picks, and that was the most welcoming restaurant. What are you getting at when you say most welcoming restaurant?
You know, the winner here is Elsa's on the Park, and Elsa's, in addition to having great hamburgers and other great foods and at reasonable prices, it's also just a really eclectic, diverse crowd on a regular basis. And you know, I think there are other restaurants in Milwaukee that can boast the same thing, but there, you know, it's a little bit rare. And so I'm always really happy to go in there and just see the diversity of the community reflected in the clientele.
We should. We were talking about how summer for many of us feels like it ends on Labor Day weekend. Mm-hmm. However, the summer festival season, the festivals don't necessarily end at Labor Day. And in the category, within the editor's picks, in the category Best New Festival is a festival that's coming up in just a few weeks.
Yes, it's the Fifth Street Festival, and this will be its second iteration. And it happens in Walker's Point. And I have not been. This was a pick of Rachel Steinbring. But it sounds great, and I'm going to check it out.
It is a Saturday, September 22nd, so
yes.
Just a few short days away. And we should note that it's really not too far away from that water tower.
Exactly. So look up. Hashtag look up.
All right. Well, we can't let the opportunity pass without making reference to the best French bulldog.
Okay. So this year, the summer was our second annual Best Frenchie contest that we have the finals at Bastille Days. And this year's winner is Jean-Pierre. And so we sat down with Jean-Pierre. I didn't, but someone who speaks French bulldog sat down with Jean-Pierre.
And Jean-Pierre looks so distinguished in this picture.
He's a very distinguished French bulldog, very handsome, and he knows it. He expresses in his interview a great interest in Mila, who is Giannis's golden doodle. And so he's looking for a date. Mila, if you're listening, I can hook you up. But he's very charming.
Well, that seems like as good a place as any to end. But, of course, all the Reader's Choice picks are in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. Carol, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Carol Nixon is the editor and publisher of Milwaukee Magazine. The Best of Milwaukee feature is in the September issue of the magazine, which is out now. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Sadly, there was no award for Best Local Daily Radio Interview
Show.
There
wasn't?
There was not, or we would have won, hands down. Anyway, we thank you for liking what we do. Lake Effect comes your way weekdays at 10 here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.